This is The Rounds Table.
Welcome back, Rounds Table listeners. This is John Fralick, one of your hosts. Today, I'm joined by a special guest, Dr. Marcus Povitz. Dr. Povitz is a respirologist and sleep medicine specialist at the University of Calgary. He is the program director for the Sleep Disorders Medicine Area of Focus Competency Training Program at the University of Calgary. Dr. Povitz is a busy clinician and continues to be active in clinical research about sleep-disordered breathing. Today, he's here to talk to us about all things OSA. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, John. This has been one of my lifelong ambitions to be on a podcast.
Hey, I'm glad we could make this work out for you. Let's take it from there. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that I was hoping we could chat about. I think first, though, I was hoping we could discuss a little bit about the overlap of OSA and hypertension. In my clinic, I see a lot of patients for workup of hypertension, and in those who have symptoms suggestive of OSA, I'll send them for sleep testing. But what does the evidence show for the benefits of treating patients with OSA and hypertension? Does it lower their blood pressure? And beyond this, are there other cardiovascular benefits?
It's a great question, an important question. And, you know, hypertension was one of the first recognized associations with obstructive sleep apnea, and probably the most well-studied condition in terms of the benefits for treatment of OSA in individuals, both with hypertension and resistant hypertension. There have been a number of studies to the point where there's now actually a number of meta-analysis, both on the issue of routine hypertension and resistant hypertension. In this situation, use of CPAP has been shown to be effective for both cases. The effectiveness in terms of reduction in blood pressure is somewhere on the order of 2 or 3 millimeters of mercury, 3 for the systolic and 2 for the diastolic, which is my understanding of what the average outcome is for a given blood pressure medication over a large patient set. Similarly, with resistant hypertension, presumably because they have worse hypertension, actually see greater benefits of 5 millimeters mercury reduction in systolic blood pressure, or about 4 in the diastolic blood pressure. So with that sort of behind us, the focus of research in sleep medicine has been on cardiometabolic disease and cardiovascular disease. One study that I must have seen 100 times at presentations is done in 2005. From a group in Spain, Marin is the first author, where they looked at individuals who had simple snoring without sleep apnea, mild sleep apnea, moderate sleep apnea, treated sleep apnea, and then untreated severe sleep apnea. And they showed that there was a 6-fold difference in the rate of cardiovascular events over, I think it was about a 12-year follow-up period. Since then, it's sort of been common practice to treat patients for moderate or severe sleep apnea to reduce cardiovascular risk, to the point that it probably became difficult to do clinical trials. But more recently, there have been 3 large randomized controlled trials done in different settings, but with similar cohorts of patients. So this was the SAVE study, which was done in Australia and China. The RICATSA study, which was done in Scandinavia, and the Isaac study done by the same Spanish consortium. And those studies had similar entry criteria of moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea. But because sleep apnea is associated with sleepiness, they had to exclude individuals who had quite significant symptoms of sleepiness as defined by the Epworth sleepiness score. So individuals who were, let's say, minimally symptomatic but with significant sleep apnea were randomized to CPAP or observation for the duration of the study. And unfortunately, all these studies were limited by poor adherence with CPAP. Conventionally, CPAP adherence is defined as use on greater than 5 nights a week for more than 4 hours at a time. And none of these studies met that metric. Okay. The largest of studies was the SAVE trial, and they were able to do post-hoc analysis looking at the most adherent patients and show that there was likely still some benefit, although that was in a post-hoc analysis. And so it's left us with a bit of a quandary as to whether CPAP is ineffective or simply not sufficiently tolerable for patients who are not symptomatic. There's also the argument that perhaps the symptomatic patients are the ones who have the most to gain from use of CPAP, both from symptom perspective and from cardiovascular risk reduction perspective. The challenge would be convincing people that that's ethical to randomize somebody who's symptomatic and might, you know, crash their car while they're on control therapy.
That's interesting. I mean, the 5 millimeter of mercury in the certain patient population is pretty darn impressive for lowering blood pressure. Like that would be, you know, a win from a lot of patients' perspective. And the other thing, of course, like the people that tolerate it, so a lot of them just say like, I feel so much better. Like they're sleeping better. They're more rested. But I guess I can appreciate that. Yeah. The cardiovascular benefits may be a little gray, and you're right. It seems like it'd be very difficult to do a randomized controlled trial in an ethical way, with what we know so far about, sleep apnea and the probable and the known benefits of CPAP. It's a great takeaway though about the blood pressure lowering, because sometimes that's all patients need to hear. Like, hey, I might be able to get you off a medication if you are able to follow through with using your CPAP. Some people might actually really value that as well.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to be upfront with patients and to give them all the information, let them make the best decision for themselves considering a therapy like this.
Now, speaking about therapy, as you know, we like talking about SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 agonists a lot on this podcast. So first question, do they work for OSA? But seriously, are there medications that help treat obstructive sleep apnea?
That's a great question, John. And in fact, I just saw a recent publication. I didn't read the whole thing yet, but there was a study, I think, of liraglutide in individuals with sleep apnea. This was investigator initiated, and so it was only a small study. But to that point, weight reduction is thought to be beneficial for the severity of sleep apnea, as well as a degree of desaturation. In theory, it would make sense that medications like liraglutide and semaglutide, if they're causing weight loss, would also be a benefit in reducing the severity of sleep apnea. But I'm not aware of a large RCT looking at that to date. There are other studies or other medications that have been considered for sleep apnea, both to reduce the severity of sleep apnea by reducing the apnea hypopnea index, or to mitigate the symptoms. Okay, things like daytime sleepiness, or cognitive impairment, which we see often in individuals with symptomatic OSA. And so to understand that, a bit of background, the mechanism of OSA is proposed to have four contributors. So we talk a lot about collapsibility of the airway, which is contributed to by obesity and fat deposition in the airway and the tongue. But there are other contributors, which I may not do justice entirely, but these have to do with other physiologic properties of the airway and of sleep, specifically the airway reflexes. So normally, like when an individual is exercising, let's say, and you start to make more effort to breathe, your airway actually dilates. And in individuals with sleep apnea during sleep, they are making more effort to breathe, but in fact, their airway is just collapsing and those airway reflexes are not working. Okay, they have decreased airway muscle tone in general. Other factors that may contribute is a concept called the arousal threshold. This can be thought of as how stable a person's sleep is. And if their sleep is unstable, then it tends to be even a mild apnea will cause interruption in their sleep and not give them enough time to activate these airway reflexes. And then the last mechanism is probably the most difficult to comprehend, is something called loop gain. And this, again, is stability, but stability of breathing. And so some people's breathing is very sensitive to changes in oxygen and carbon dioxide levels. And if your breathing is more unstable, you're more prone to apnea. And so there are medications that have approached sleep apnea from each of these angles. But the studies have been limited to date. There are ongoing efforts by pharmaceutical companies and researchers across the globe looking at different compounds. So just examples for your listeners. The most promising right now is a combination of oxybutynin, which is an anticholinergic medication used for urinary incontinence, and atomoxetine, which is a noradrenergic stimulant used in ADHD, for instance. And the combination of these two medications seems promising to increase airway muscle tone. So we're likely to see outcomes of studies like that. There have been some phase two studies, but phase three studies are ongoing. There have been other studies, sort of smaller, more limited studies, looking at acetazolamide as a diuretic, which affects carbon dioxide levels and can improve stability of breathing, improve loop gain. And then there have been a number of studies of sedating medications to try to improve sleep depth and address arousal, the arousal threshold for some individuals. And so those studies have included studies of dronabinol, which is synthetic THC, and trazodone and zopiclone. And unfortunately, those studies haven't really been successful to date. Or the other medications which are available are things that help to promote wakefulness or improve concentration because of residual symptoms despite PAP therapy, or PAP intolerance with, limiting symptoms. And so the classic oldest medication in that class is modafinil. And then more recently, approved medication in Canada anyway is solriamfetol. So these are medications that increase dopamine and norepinephrine through reuptake inhibition, most likely. And so the dopamine and norepinephrine increase wakefulness, improve concentration. There was a network meta-analysis comparing these different medications, showing that solriamfetol was most effective in that drug class, although given that it's a newer medication, it's quite a bit more costly than modafinil, for instance.
Very fascinating. I had never even heard of some of those mechanisms of action that they're targeting. And so from a practical perspective, will you consider some of these therapies then in your patients who are refractory from a symptom perspective, despite being on CPAP, or do you find that the evidence just isn't there to support it?
Yeah, I'm still hesitant about these medications. It's just easy to think of all the side effects that somebody might encounter, particularly older men giving them oxybutynin. It seems like something that is a bad idea, but I'd be quite interested in seeing the outcome of these studies. I don't know if there will be centers in Canada randomizing individuals in this, but it would be something to monitor closely. And I think, it just shows the need for additional therapy other than CPAP, and the promise for the future, perhaps, that 10 or 15 years from now will be talking about a completely different concept of treatment of OSA.
Definitely. I'll keep an eye out too on that liraglutide study. We'll see what they found. You had sent me another thing as well about treatment involving a neuromuscular stimulator. And so I guess of those other mechanisms that you talked about, like how does this one work, and is there evidence to support its use as well?
Yeah, so it's really interesting treatment approach, and something that unfortunately we don't see a lot in Canada. Okay. So there was a paper looking at an implantable hypoglossal nerve stimulator. And so hypoglossal nerve is what provides motor input to the tongue. It's actually a device called Inspire, where it's sensing the pleura to measure respiratory effort, and then driving the hypoglossal nerve to squeeze the tongue and open the airway. And this was actually proven in an RCT in 2014 for individuals who had BMI less than 32 who were intolerant or refusing CPAP. So that's 10 years ago. And the device has never been submitted to Health Canada for approval. I looked it up yesterday in preparation for this talk, and it's $30,000 to $40,000 US. And so if you compare that to what individuals pay for a CPAP machine in Canada, it's just cost prohibitive. And the need for OR space and experts trained in this, I think, has limited the interest from the company in terms of trying to market it in Canada. But I would say they do market it on American television, and it's not infrequent that I have a request to find out more about this from patients. So that concept, though, and the fact that this trial was successful led to other devices going down that route. So it's possible we'll see this in Canada in the future. There is a device that is marketed in Canada called Xcyte OSA. This is a device that's used in the daytime, and it's sort of like a TENS machine for the tongue. It's a handheld device that you put in your mouth for 20 minutes a day for 6 weeks. And it's meant to increase your airway muscle tone. And it's been studied in snorers and in individuals with mild sleep apnea and shown some benefit in those groups. And there are other devices that are being studied, implantable devices that go under the chin, for instance, to provide direct electrical stimulation to the tongue muscle. I think the future is down this route somewhat, whether it be with pharmacologic stimulation of airway tone or direct electrical stimulation as alternatives to PAP therapy.
Very interesting. TENS for the tongue. Do you have a sense as a ballpark, like what the cost is for that device?
Well, I can speak to the situation here in Calgary. Its initial price was about $1,000 for the handheld device. And then there's a consumable, which is replaced every 90 days. And I believe that was another $90. The marketing pitch was that it came with a cell phone app that would coach you in appropriate use. And the company that was marketing it would provide support through the app for individuals who purchase that. And it is available through home care companies who sell CPAP otherwise here in Calgary.
Technology is something else. We'll change gears a little bit and we'll talk a bit about your research. Last year, you published in BMJ Thorax, looking at the association between OSA and COVID-19. And despite our best efforts, COVID-19, although it's maybe a better situation than it was a couple of years ago, it's not gone away completely. First, I guess, what was the hypothesis that led to this research and what was the study design here?
This is a study I was very fortunate to work with a group of investigators in Canada, and mostly based in Ontario. This project came about during the pandemic based on some observations that, you know, we all were seeing patients with COVID-19. And those of us in the sleep medicine world saw a lot of the same patients on the COVID ward as we were seeing in our clinics prior to the pandemic. By this, I mean, there seemed to be some predilection for obesity, particularly the worst outcomes with the original COVID strain and Delta wave seemed to be associated strongly with the same cardiometabolic risk as we see in obstructive sleep apnea. And so there were a number of other implications for the pandemic on sleep apnea care. And so this was part of a larger group of studies that we were able to do. And so Dr. Kanzerska, who's based in Ottawa, was the lead investigator. And so this study was a bit opportunistic as well, in the sense that in Ontario, they have excellent data collection on who is using or who is prescribed CPAP. And Dr. Kanzerska has been able to derive an algorithm to identify individuals at high risk of sleep apnea. And we were able to link that with data about COVID-19 positivity from viral swabs. And so this study was done as a retrospective study using health administrative data housed at the Institute for Clinical Evaluative Sciences, or ICES. Essentially, we followed all individuals who had purchased PAP for 5 years leading up to the pandemic. So that's March 2015 to March 2020. And in Ontario, because they have funding for CPAP, they have good data on who's purchased it. And again, we were able to use this validated case definition as well as a secondary way of identifying individuals with high probability of OSA. And then we were able to create a control group based on individuals who have never purchased CPAP and never had sleep testing in Ontario. So the main outcomes that we looked at were the risks of contracting COVID-19 and then the risks of serious complications, which were defined as emergency room presentation, admission to hospital, ICU-related admission, and COVID-19-related mortality or death within 30 days of a positive test. What we were able to show using this approach was that individuals who had obstructive sleep apnea were at a higher risk of contracting COVID-19 and at about a risk of relative risk of 1.2 and a risk of ED visits, hospitalization, ICU admission, which was quite elevated, about 1.5 times the risk seen with matched controls who did not have obstructive sleep apnea.
50% increased risk. Yeah. And you're right. Like it's maybe not surprising when you do reflect back on the average patient that we were seeing. A lot of those patients would have had overlapping risk profiles and clinical phenotypes that would be suspicious for sleep apnea if it wasn't yet diagnosed. And then you reminded me too, we had all this uncertainty around whether people could even use their sleep apnea devices in hospital. Jeez, what a time that was, eh?
So for your listeners here now in Calgary, we actually had banned PAP devices because of fear of aerosol generating, you know, medical procedures and risk to healthcare providers. And that sort of filtered into the general population as well, with a lot of patients choosing to stop their PAP therapy during the pandemic because of the belief that they were going to propagate the virus.
I didn't even consider that. Yeah, sure. Like you don't want to spread it to like your kids who are in the room next door. So absolutely, when there's uncertainty, that makes a lot of sense. Along the lines of sleep apnea devices as well, and I don't know how widespread this is known, but there's this Philips recall, which has been a pretty big deal. Can you kind of tell us, our listeners, about like what is this? What happened? What's the scale of the problem?
How much time do you have? So this was another event that sort of compounded things during the pandemic. In about April 2021, the FDA and Philips came out with a recall on all Philips devices, essentially, that had been manufactured since 2009. And so for your listeners, Philips Respironics would be one of the leading PAP manufacturers worldwide. And the other big companies that we have in Canada would be ResMed and Fisher & Paykel. So Philips had used a type of sound abatement foam in their devices, which was found to, over time, be at risk of disintegrating. And then having these particles of abatement foam that was made out of polyurethane passed through the hose and mask and into the patient. The other potential issue with this foam was that it was at risk of off-gassing, okay? And that would put off toluene and related compounds through the airflow system. So the recall was fairly abrupt, basically told patients to contact their providers and to register their machines for repair, and that they should cease and desist from using their PAP devices. In practice, you know, I think I would admit that patients often complain about airway side effects of CPAP. And for the most part, we thought that was because of the high volume of airflow and the drawing effect on the airway. But in hindsight now, it seems like that may have also been due to this foam. And what patients report more specifically is they get sort of black particles coming through their mask and they're coughing it up in the morning. So this happened in 2021, right at the height of the chip shortage as well. And so ResMed, which is probably the larger company which manufactures CPAP, was unable to meet the demand from all the patients now trying to replace their CPAP machines. And so so we got into a scenario of rationing where patients were on wait lists for PAP therapy. And many patients were potentially harmed because they needed this therapy to prevent progression to respiratory failure. And, you know, they stopped their therapy because they were scared to death of using it. So that was one way that people were harmed. And in general, I think it just highlighted the difficulty in terms of quality control that Philips was having. From a regulatory perspective, the requirements for approval of these devices is perhaps too minimal. You know, if you create a new CPAP machine, the approval from Health Canada and FDA is relatively simple. It doesn't change the design very much. And the fact is that there are millions of people affected by this recall. And manufacturers had no way to identify patients. And, you know, I can speak even for our own clinic. You know, we may know who we've seen in the past year, but we don't have a clear record of who's on what machine, what age it was, and then we're not able to track people down necessarily. And, you know, you compare that to pharmacy data or to other medical devices which are implantable, you know, where people walk around with a card in their wallet for the rest of their lives. It was honestly pure chaos. And, you know, now we're almost 3 years later, and I still see patients every week who are using Philips machines that have been recalled, who are either unaware that their machine's been recalled, who've registered but have not had replacement machines provided or any replacement of the foam. You know, it's really a difficult situation in terms of trying to move this forward on a more than a case-by-case basis. So for us, we're now able to help patients along, push things forward for them to make sure that patients who need therapy are treated. But there have been more consequences to the point now where Philips has been banned from selling CPAP machines in the United States. And there's question whether they'll pull out of the market entirely. And what the impacts that will be moving forward for patients who need CPAP machines in terms of availability and then price of equipment.
Wow, that would just be such a scary situation to be in as a patient, a logistical nightmare as a clinician. Like, you know, I guess I would have just assumed there would be a registry, like you get a device, so it gets registered. But like, clearly that wasn't the case. Maybe not to like break any confidentiality, of course, but like in general, have you noticed that it's affected patient trust and kind of willingness to then even use a modified CPAP machine or one that's not part of the recall? Like has that kind of affected compliance or adherence at all? Or have you been able to kind of reassure patients enough?
You know, I think a lot of that comes back to the patient provider relationship and patients who I see, you know, who I have a relationship with. I haven't really seen a lot of pushback from them, but I'll tell you an anecdote that I can tell you, which is talking to my mother. She knows two people who've died in the last, let's say, 5 years from lung cancer, and both of them were CPAP users. And while the data actually doesn't support the cancer risk, I've had to field questions from my mother a few times about, you know, was the CPAP machine the cause of the cancer in these individuals? And why is there asbestos in CPAP machines, which, of course, there isn't. But it just goes to show, like, how things are potentially twisted and sort of lay conversations in terms of understanding what the risks are here. And not to say the recall's been overdone, but, you know, I think they didn't have much information at the onset in terms of what the risks were of cancer. And FDA has recognized over 500 cases of deaths associated with this recall. But, you know, we did, it happened another opportunistic study we were able to do. We had just completed a study looking at cancer risk related to sleep apnea in Ontario. Again, a health administrative data study. And when this recall came out. And so we were able to quickly do a reanalysis of the data based on PAP provider, which is also in that same database in Ontario. And that study may be small and the follow-up not long enough given the time it takes for a person to develop the cancer, but we didn't actually measure a signal in terms of, we didn't find increased risk in that study that we were able to do.
That's really amazing that the data set actually has the provider information. Like, yeah, that's cool. Wow.
Well, it's, you know, one good side of bureaucracy.
Great administrative data sets.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that'll probably just about wrap things up. But before we finish up, I don't know, are there any kind of sleep medicine pearls that you wanted to share with the listeners before we go?
Well, I think as a sleep specialist at the University Center, I see some of the most complex patients. I see a lot of people who are PAP intolerant. And I see, you know, all of the patients who are unhappy with their initial assessment and treatment. I'd say that the key things when talking to patients about obstructive sleep apnea and CPAP is to work with patients where they are. I try as much as possible to avoid high pressure tactics in terms of trying to get patients on board. I try to give people time and space to think about things and use their rational thinking in terms of what the potential benefits to them will be. I think it's important to consider non-CPAP options. So this would be things like dental devices or surgery, which we haven't talked about today, but which could be available in Canada, things like upper airway surgery or maxillomandibular advancement surgery. I think it's really important as providers to think about impacts on driving and occupational risk. This is particularly important for heavy truck drivers and other situations where safety is critical. The key there is to be empathetic and, you know, to not create an adversarial situation. But most people who are in those situations, they don't want to hurt anybody. And so making sure they're aware of the increased risk of untreated sleep apnea in those settings. And then in terms of who to treat question, as I may have created some ambiguity about who's best to treat, I think that the most important ones are those who have significant hypoxemia, and particularly those who have daytime gas exchange abnormalities. I think hypoxemia is probably the driver of things like hypertension and cardiometabolic disease, and I think future studies looking at those areas are going to focus on newer metrics of hypoxemia and trying to make sure that that's adequately treated. And those are the patients who I really try to push a little bit harder to do something about their sleep apnea, whether that's weight loss with semaglutide or to get treated with PAP therapy.
That's great. Well, Marcus, thank you very much for all of this information. Sleep medicine is just one of those areas that I've just kind of neglected a little bit from, you know, my own personal training and knowledge about. So this has been really nice to have you on the podcast. And whenever these fancy trials come out showing liraglutide, semaglutide as the cure for sleep apnea, we'll have you back. Okay.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a good night. The Rounds Table is hosted online at healthydebate.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Rounds Table. Thanks to our audio editors, Emilio Garcia Flores and Arjun Sharma. Also thanks to Amol Verma, founder of The Rounds Table, and Kieran Quinn, the previous director. We'd also like to give a big thanks to Seema Marwaha, editor-in-chief at Healthy Debate, for all the support.